So there's still time to do that. All right. Tracy's going to work on that, and we'll get going anyway. Of course, the principal character of the book of Exodus is Moses. And we're going to see an interesting transition in the life of this man. He starts off, how does he start off? How do we first meet Moses? Where is he? No, not as an adult. He is born, and 3 months later, he's what? Sitting in a box in the river one day that she had prepared. And why was that? Why did she do such a what would normally be an outrageous thing? We might consider that to be outrageous. Why would she put her daughter? How about it, Josh? Daughter, son. All right. Pharaoh had issued a decree that all of the male children of the Hebrews should be thrown into the river. Got a map here that, of course, most of us know Egypt, and the Nile River is the probably the principal resource of Egypt, even as it is today. And you look up in where the Nile splits into so many different rivers and streams, that would be known as the Nile Delta. The land of Goshen. What's significant about the land of Goshen? Okay, very rich, but who settled there? Yeah, the Israelites had settled there because they had been given that land as a result of when they moved down, when Joseph's family moved down, Jacob and his sons and his children, about 70 people, 75, depends on how you account them and what source that you consult or reference. They grew into a massive number of people. God had blessed them. This was not by accident that they had grown them the way that they did. And they were living in the land of Goshen. But the Egyptians were, over the process of time, the Egyptians became afraid of them and decided to make them their slaves. And they began building. What did they begin building? Store cities, Pithom and Ramses. Most people, most authorities today believe that those were somewhere near or in the Nile Delta region, right up in there. There are some archaeologists who have claimed over time that they have found these cities. I don't know if that can be absolutely substantiated. One even claims that there's a difference in bricks in the lower part in terms of the amount of straw that they have. I mean, I wouldn't want to go too far with that, but it's an interesting thing to list to read. And if you ever see any writings about that, you might read that. But there are different authorities who have claimed that different places actually constitute these store cities. And again, it's a little hard to be absolutely dogmatic and say, yes, we found them. There's another interesting thing to read about this period of time that we're going to read with respect to Egypt. And I think Bernie may have alluded to this. If I repeat something you said, Bernie, or if I get something wrong, just correct me. Or if I say something wrong, anybody correct me. As I understand it, there was a ruling people that had come 1700 B.C. to about 1500 B.C., the Hyksos people who had invaded Egypt and had taken that area over. When they finally drove them out, they destroyed all records. They were so embarrassed and so humiliated by that reign of time that they decided they would absolutely erase all history, all records of it. Ordinarily, there are records that you see. I have read that there are very good, well-kept records of ancient Egypt up to a point. And then they're gone for centuries. And it's believed that that may have been the reason that they actually destroyed those. So you don't have a lot of secular history that corroborates the period of time that we're going to study about like you do some other periods of the Bible. Again, that's not a reason for us to doubt the Bible. Again, there are explanations for that. There are no records as I understand, the Hyksos dynasty ruled Egypt at about the same time that the Israelites were there. Once they drove them out, They wanted to erase all vestiges of that period of time. I even read that they had gone to wipe out even some of the monuments that referenced those people. They didn't want to think about them anymore. So if they destroyed records of that period of time, naturally the records that have talked, that would have talked about the Israelites living in that area would have also probably been wiped out as well. Another thing to think about, too, is the attitude of the Egyptians toward the Israelites. You remember there's a statement made regarding shepherds, and that goes back to what we're talking about with Goshen a minute ago. There's a statement made in the book of Genesis regarding the Egyptians' attitude toward shepherds. They hated them. They didn't like them at all. A loathsome or a stench to them. And we see that attitude still permeating their thought, even as we enter, you know, into this realm of study. I believe have we gotten all the way through chapter 2? Pretty close. We were in the latter part because I believe we read the part about Moses, of course, and when we read about Moses, and if you look at Moses himself, and I'm out of order here, Moses can be divided up in about three periods, three 40-year periods. First 40 years were his early life in Egypt. Still a young man at 40, right? Some of you would consider that still 40. But Acts 7:23 gives us some history regarding his attitude at the time. He thought God was going to use him to deliver his people. He knew who he was. And now he had the advantage of being raised as a child by his own mother. And it's obvious that she taught him some things. The Bible doesn't go into a lot of detail about that. But it's an inescapable conclusion, I believe, that his mother had to have taught him a great deal about who he was and that he was not really an Egyptian. Because when he's 40 years old, he decides he's going to be a deliverer for the people. And he goes about, and he goes out, and of course we have the story where an Egyptian is beating an Israelite, and what does he do? Kills him. Looks one way this way, looks one way that. Coast is clear, he killed him. Was it the next day? He goes out again. Two Jews, two Hebrews are fighting one another, he tries to break them up. Why are you striking your brother? What does the other one say? Yeah, you're going to kill me like you did the Egyptian? And even word got to Pharaoh, and what did Moses have to do? Had to run for his life, so he went to Midian. And the way that we know he spent 40 years in Midian, because there's a passage in Exodus 7, early on in the story of when he appeared to Pharaoh, when he first went to Pharaoh, it says that he was 80 years old. So again, 40, another 40. He's 80 before he even starts really getting to a point of leading the Israelites. Think about that. An 80-year-old, and he lives another 40 years after that, and we're told that he lived to 40 years old, 120 years old, another 40 on top of that 80. Let's go back. The land of Midian, you see it circled right there, but most maps will also show it in this region as well, that it was on both sides of the Gulf of Arabia. Is that the Gulf of Arabia, I believe it is? Aqaba. Thank you. He's on both, it's actually on both sides, and it is believed that Sinai, by most authorities, that was down in this region. There are some people who put it over here in Arabia. There are some who put it up here. Again, you can't be absolutely dogmatic about it because I don't believe we absolutely know, according to what I've read. But most people believe, based on the chronology and the mention of places that are known in the Sinai Peninsula during the warning, pretty much lets us know, helps us to believe that it was down here. And if he is living in the land of Midian when God appears to him, as we're going to study in a few minutes, well, that would make sense. Because God tells him, you're going to come back to this mountain. He meets a woman there, and remember we read the passage last week that he assisted them in getting the water for their flocks. They had some real good characters back in that day and age. Women would pour the get the water drawn for their flocks, and then the shepherds would come and take advantage of that and run them away. And apparently they'd start that process over again. And Moses actually helped them. And when they went back early one day, got home early that day, their father said, "Well, how'd you get home so quick?" And they said, "Who helped us?" "An Egyptian helped us." That tells us that he was recognizable as an Egyptian, either in addition to the way he dressed, the way he spoke, maybe his dialect, maybe the words that he used, maybe the language that he used, he could be recognized as an Egyptian. So, obviously, being raised as an Egyptian by Pharaoh's son, he would have been recognized as that. So, he stays there, and he winds up marrying Zipporah. And she has a son, they name him Gershom. And why do they name him Gershom? Yeah, Gershom means stranger or foreigner. And he says, "I've been a sojourner in a foreign land." Well, after a period of time, verse 23 tells us that the king of Egypt dies. And the sons of Israel sighed because of their bondage, and they cried out. And God was listening. Remember, what did Joseph tell his people on his deathbed? I think we read it Sunday. Yeah, "Take care of my bones. God is going to do what? God will visit you. God will take you up out of this land," I believe it says. And God, now the time has come, and we don't always want to put, sometimes we want to put our own timetable on God, and God has His own timetable for His own purposes. And it's time now. God hears the groanings. God remembers the covenant that He has with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What is that covenant? "I'm going to do what? I'm going to make what of you, Abraham? Great nation? What else? Bless your seed, okay. Well, through your seed, what? All nations of the earth shall be blessed." That one's still a way off. And what's the other one? The one that we're really going to zoom in on right now. "I'm going to give you this land of Canaan." We'll talk about that in just a minute as well. So as chapter 3 begins, Moses is out one day taking care of his flock. Boy, he's really gone a long ways in terms of his career development. He has gone from a prince of Egypt to what? Not putting down shepherds or people who take care of animals, but his lifestyle has changed significantly, don't you think? And the Bible tells us something about that. Turn over to, it's either Acts 7 or it's Hebrews 11. Let's just go to both. Let's go to Acts 7 first. And this is kind of, we're not going to read all of this. I just want you to notice some of these verses. And the thing we talked about a minute ago in 22 tells us Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, a man of great power and word and deeds. And then it talks about he is approaching the age of 40 and entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And it talks about that event where he saw an Egyptian beating an Israelite. Verse 25, "He supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand." Let's go over to, if you look down chapter verse 29 at this remark, and this is in response to the attitude of the Israelite who he tried to break up the fight. What does he say in verse 29? Right, so he gives that lifestyle up, kind of by force, because Pharaoh is trying to kill him at this point. So he goes into the land of Midian, and he meets Zipporah there, and he becomes the father of two sons. Let's go over to Hebrews 11. You know, we're given a few details in the New Testament by inspiration that we don't necessarily have in the Old Testament. Hebrews 11. One thing interesting to note very early on in this chapter, or midway through this chapter, we should say, verse 23, By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw that he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. That surmises some faith on the part of not only Moses later on, but of his parents as well. By faith, Moses, when he has grown up, what did he refuse? Yeah, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He was willing to give that up to be a deliverer of his people, choosing to endure ill treatment with the people of God rather than enjoy the passing pleasures of sins. And he leaves Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. He had a faith in God. And it goes on to talk about more of the faith that he had. So this is a man of faith even now. His faith is going to grow incredibly over these next 40 years that we learn more about him. So he's out one day, taking care of the flock, and an angel of the Lord appears to him in a blazing fire. Now, I'm assuming he watched this for a while. Otherwise, he would not have came to the conclusion this bush is not burning up. You see something on fire, you watch it a few minutes, and you go on. This is something, of course, he probably watched for a while, and it still did not burn up. So what did he say? I've got to go look at this. This is a marvelous sight. Why is the bush not burned up? And when he began to look, what happened? Take off your shoe. Well, he first says, Moses, Moses, here I am. Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place you are standing on is holy ground. And of course, what does verse 6 say? I am who? I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Do you think Moses knew who those characters were? Had he been taught about who the people of God were? What if he had never been taught that? What if his parents had never had the kind of faith that they had? Oh. If you think about this entire story, you see the hand of God in it. From everything, from his mother putting him in the basket, to Pharaoh's daughter coming and taking him, to his sister coming and saying, you want me to get a nurse for that child? God is in control of the situation. It may not look like it, and the people who were living it in that day may not have understood it all, and they might have had his parents, for all I know, died, never had any clue in their lives as to what was going to happen and how great this boy was going to be. But God was going to use him. Moses hides his face. He's afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. I have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters and because of their sufferings. Rob, read verse 8 and verse 9. Okay, he's talking to Moses now. I've come down to deliver them. I'm ready to do something about this. You know, Moses was ready himself, thought God could use him 40 years before. I don't know if Moses had forgotten about all that or not, but now God's ready. Moses was ready earlier, now God's ready, 40 years later. Think about all the events that happened in his life, all the day-to-day activities, all the discussions with his wife and his children, all the things they were interested in. 40 years. We don't know anything about. But now God's ready. I want you to look at this chart. I got this out of the Waldron's book on geography. And this is a depiction of the various nations that descended. Remember after the what happened at the Tower of Babel? How did God choose to stop that? Okay, he confused their language, and they scattered, and they moved to different places. And from these peoples from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Remember, there were only 8 people in the ark, right? Noah and his wife, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives. 8 people. Out of 8 people descended everybody. We are all descended from them. Well, if you'll look, look at Ham here. Take a look at verse 7 that listed all those nations? Verse 8. I'm going to take you to the land of the Canaanites. Okay? And he mentions the Jebusites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Jebusites and the Hivites. And of course, we already read about the Egyptians. They're all descended from Ham. What was said about Ham in the book of Genesis after he did something that was wrong? He was cursed. And I got a bug that's chasing me. He was cursed. What's significant about this particular son? Who descended from him? Christ. And of course, we see the Israelites here. Ham's descendants were cursed, and they will ultimately be servants of Shem's descendants, I believe, or of the other's descendants. If you look through the ark of the not chronology and not archaeology. The lineage. Lineage. So, thank you. There's more emphasis placed on Shem. We keep a track of Shem's descendants, even from early on. Way before anybody knew really about the Christ, the Bible is keeping up and tracking Shem's descendants. Because that's who Christ would come from. But these people descended from Ham. And they are going to suffer the result. The result is going to be they're going to be driven out of the land of Canaan as a result. I thought that was an interesting point to keep up with. As God says, I'm going to drive them out, you're going to take their land. And it's not just going to take their land. This is a good land, flowing with milk and honey, a spacious land. Instead of living in bondage in the land of Goshen and being beaten and being forced to make bricks for the Egyptians, being slaves, you're going to come out of that and you're going to be taken to the land of Canaan. Anyway, interesting point too, probably many of us are descended from Japheth, if you think about it, because many of us would have been descended from groups of people in that area. So anyway, interesting thing to think about. Now if you look at a map here, this is approximately where most of those peoples lived. Canaanite would have been over here. This would be the entire land of Canaan, really. Of course, Moab and Edom and Midian, and we'll meet some of these people as we go. Ammonites, and of course the Hittites were further up. And of course the Philistines were sea people. They lived along the sea coast of the Mediterranean. Now, they are not specifically mentioned, but they may have been caught up in the general term of Canaanites. It's said, too, that Perizzites may have been a term for a conglomeration of people, sort of a mixture of different races, because you can't find a lot of detail about Perizzites. At least I couldn't. So their cries come up to me. So who am I going to send you to, Moses? You're going to go to Pharaoh. You're going to bring my people out, the sons of Israel. Moses says, well, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And what's God say to him in verse 11 or verse 12? I'll be with you. And this will be the sign that I sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship on this mountain. That'll be the sign that you'll know this is real, that I'm real. Was that good enough for Moses? Moses' faith is not quite there yet. It's not there yet. It's going to get there. He's going to go from a person who is just not quite there to a person of incredible faith, probably a man who drew closer to God in terms of, except for Jesus, did anyone ever become closer to God the way that he taught with God than Moses? Yeah. 40 years ago, as a younger guy, I keep trying to say that's young. 40, 47, that's all young. As a younger man, or as a somewhat younger man, he was more enthusiastic. Not quite as enthusiastic now. Even though we know later on that his natural strength had not abated, his attitudes had changed some in 40 years. So, Moses says to God, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I'll say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. So they may say, well, what is his name? What am I going to say when they ask me what this God's name is? And God says, what? I am. And some versions may say, I am who I am. I am has sent you. What is the significance of that? How do you explain that? One, the God who exists, the God who has always been, the God who is ever present, I am. What else do you think of? Do you think of anything other than that? No. It's a pretty deep thought, if you think about it, but always keep that one in mind, because Jesus will appropriate that term to himself later on. And the Jews later on, and when Jesus uses that term of himself, the Jews who heard it get the point. And they know immediately he is referring to himself as God. Yeah. They most likely were influenced by the gods of Egypt, and I've got a book somewhere, I've got to find it, that discusses not only the gods, but the customs and the beliefs and the medical practices of the Egyptians. The things they thought would cure you, that the it's just bizarre. And they would have been heavily influenced by that. And now, they're going to be put in a situation where they say there's one God, the God. And it's going to be a pretty radical change from them. I have to believe that they would have retained some knowledge of their history. Moses certainly did. And God says, the God of your fathers. So they knew about God to an extent. Now, how much they had lost, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think any of us can know. But they're going to accept it right away pretty quick. Until, you know, they're ready. After they see the signs, they're ready to accept it and go forward. And, of course, their faith's not going to be real strong, because they're going to be ready to abandon Moses too. So God furthermore says to Moses, you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. So they would have known these people, these characters. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. And of course it refers here as the Lord. Go and gather the elders of Israel and tell them what's happened. The God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob has appeared to me. Again, they would have known who they were. I am indeed concerned about you. I know what's going on to you, about you, and I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to bring you up. And he mentions these nations again, to a good land with milk and honey. And he says, they'll listen to you. And the elders will come to the king of Egypt with you. You will say, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And what are they going to ask to do? For how long? Verse 18. 3 days' journey. Let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know He's not going to let you, except under compulsion, under being forced. So I'm going to stretch out my hand and strike Egypt. And we'll read about all those different plagues that happened, with the miracles that I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, He will let you go. And I'm also going to give you favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And what will they do as the chapter ends? How will they plunder the Egyptians? They're going to go and rob them? They're just going to hand it to them. But God will be influencing their attitudes. Okay, they will borrow from their neighbor. Okay, I didn't. The idea is the same. I mean, they're going to get some things from their neighbors. Articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you'll put them on your sons and daughters, and you'll plunder the Egyptians that way. That's an interesting way to plunder someone, but that's what's going to happen. Chapter 4, what's Moses say now? What if they won't believe me or listen to me? They may say the Lord hadn't appeared to you. He really has changed his tune a lot, hasn't he? He went out on his own and thinking that he was going to carry this great uprising and lead his people to rebel against the Egyptians. And now, here's the greatest opportunity he's ever had. Here's the real opportunity with God behind him, and he's not ready. And God said, what's that in your hand? And he said, a staff. He throws it to the ground, and what happens? Turns into a snake, and Moses, what does Moses do? He gets away from it. That's what most of us would do. He had that natural fear of snakes that most of us have. So Moses says, stretch out your hand and grab it by its tail. So he grabbed it, took hold of it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of the fathers, or their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Throughout Scripture, what principle do we know about miracles in terms of their purpose? Yeah, that's a consistent principle that you'll see throughout the Scriptures, well into the New Testament. They served a purpose of proving that this really was from God, whether it be the person doing the miracle can say, I'm really from God, and here's why. And he does something miraculous. There's another one that God has him do. Put your hand into your bosom. I'm assuming that would have been inside his garment of some in some manner. Takes it out, and what's wrong with it? Leprosy. We don't know much about leprosy today. I think it still does exist in places. But in this day and age, if you became leprous, it was an often fatal disease, wasn't it? Eventually fatal. It wasn't an immediate thing, but it would have been a terrible disease to have in terms of the effect on the skin itself and the body. And later on, we'll see they would have even been kept separate from the rest of the populations to keep it from spreading. So it's leprosy, and it had a white appearance, as I understand it. And he puts it back into his bosom again and takes it out, and it's like the rest of his flesh. He says, if they won't believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they'll believe the second. But if they will not believe even these two signs, you are now, what does he want him to do? Take some water from the Nile River. Exactly. Pour it out and it'll become blood on dry ground. Is that enough for Moses? Seen quite a bit. He's seen a burning bush that didn't burn up. He's seen the ability to throw a rod or staff on the ground, turn into a snake, pick it back up, turn back into a staff. He's had his hand changed from leprosy to back to normal. He's been assured of another sign he can do. Remember, he's not in Egypt, so he can't do this one right away. That said, get water from the Nile, remember. Not enough, is it? Please, Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither recently nor in times past. Well, that's an interesting statement based on what we read. Was it in Acts or in Hebrews? What does it say about him? Educated in all the ways of the Egyptians and mighty in what? Word and deed. Now he's claiming he's not so mighty. Maybe you can lose some of that over 40 years. And living away from what you're accustomed to. So he's claiming now he doesn't have that eloquence anymore. I can't speak well. And since you've spoken to your servant, I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. What's God's reaction to that? Who do you think you're talking to, in a sense, paraphrasing? Who made you? Who made a man's mouth? Who's the one that makes one mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? I will be with your mouth. I'll teach you what you're to say. What does he say in verse 13?
Yeah. Please, Lord, now send the message by whoever you will. This is probably the most significant one, because what's God ready to do at this point? The anger of the Lord burned against Moses. That's not a situation you want to be in. God's anger burning against you. What about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he speaks well. And he's coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he'll be glad. And you're going to speak to him and put the words in his mouth. And I will be your mouth and his mouth. And I'll teach you what you're to do. And he shall speak to you, speak for you to the people. And will be as your mouth. And you will be as God to him. So the situation is going to be Moses. Aaron's probably really going to be the front man here. He's going to be the one who probably has the most FaceTime, if you're familiar with that term, in front of all the people. And Moses is going to be the one sort of putting the words in the mouth of Aaron to the people. And you'll take your staff in your hand, and you shall perform these signs. So, apparently Moses is convinced now, because he goes back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and says, "Let me go, that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt to see if they're still alive." And Jethro says, "Go in peace." And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt. All the people who were seeking your life are dead." You know, he didn't have telephone or Fox News or any other kind of communication device to know what was going on back in Egypt, to know that the Pharaoh who was trying to kill him is now dead. You just didn't get information like that. And even in this part of the world, there are trade routes. One in particular that ran by the sea. There was another one that ran by the wilderness of Shur. But you just did not get a lot of information from here to here. In that day and age, he didn't know what was going on back in Egypt. But God tells him, people who are seeking your life are dead. So go back. And I'm going to perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I put in your power, and I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. And what is he going to say? How does he characterize the people of Israel in verse 22? His firstborn son. There's like a firstborn son to them. He says, "Let my son go, that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn." Pretty serious language here to be saying to Pharaoh, but of course this is God saying it. Now it became about at the lodging place that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Now we're not giving a lot of details in terms of what God has instructed in him here, but we know God is just and God is righteous and God is fair. So what does that imply about why God wanted to do this? Why would God have a reason to kill Moses at this point? In conjunction with what we read just after that in respect to circumcising his sons. Yeah, this implies that God had commanded it. It has to be. And of course, his wife did not like this. And it mentions the fact that she went ahead and performed performed it herself with a flint. And she actually takes what was cut off and throws it at Moses' feet. And referencing the blood that would have come from that, "You're indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." So she let him alone. So, excuse me, he let him alone. I think that's referring to God here. And at the time she said, "You are a bridegroom of blood," because of the circumcision. So that's why she said that. And the Bible gives us a commentary on that. So God expected his people to embrace this covenant of circumcision. And for some reason, as I understand it, Moses had resisted this at this point. So the Lord says to Moses, "Go to meet Moses in the wilderness." So he goes and he meets him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses tells Aaron all the words of the Lord. And Moses goes and assembles all the elders of the sons of Israel. He speaks the words that Moses has heard from God. Aaron's speaking these words. Remember, this is Aaron being the spokesman. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, that they had seen their affliction, they bowed low and worshipped. Got a pretty good attitude now. That won't last.
But right now, they're ready for to be delivered. They've had enough of Egypt as well. And Moses is now taking his place as being one who's going to be a deliverer for Egypt. That is, God using him as a deliverer. Any question? This is going to be a fairly rapid study. I think Bernie explained that the other day. We will cover roughly 2 chapters per class session. We may slow down some, and I don't know how much detail we'll give all the specific areas of law and the tabernacle, but right now we're going to spend time studying the chronology, and I hope it's interesting, and we'll try to make it interesting as we go along. It is an interesting story. Seeing the progression of Moses in his life is a good illustration and example for us to see how we can add to our character and how we can grow and progress in terms of our closeness to God. If he can do it, so can we. Okay. Yeah. You know, even though they did remember, and they still kept some of their teaching, how much they kept, we don't know, and just how diligent they were, and how that might have fallen out of practice for various reasons like you're talking about, because the covenant of circumcision had been talked about already in the book of Genesis. I appreciate your comments.